At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome into the best in paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. I want to start off today by doing a dedication. I want to dedicate this show, first of all, to our good friend Jerry Pauly, who passed away last week at an early age from Hillbilly Horror Stories. Our show today also deals with a good friend who passed away by the name of Jim Willis, who we're going to talk about his book today. His book is Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money. It's ironic that we scheduled in Jim's book today. Jim's been gone for a little while now, but I found out about Jim's passing in an unusual way. We actually had another one of Visible Ink Press's authors on. We were talking about his project, and after the show, he said, "Yeah, I guess between you, me, and the fence post, I've been tapped to kind of help with some of Jim's projects." I said, "Well, what happened to Jim?" I was like, "What happened?" Because Jim is one of my all-time favorite authors, and I hadn't heard that anything had happened with Jim. He said, "Oh, he passed away," and I was immediately crushed, because not only is he one of my favorite authors, he's one of my uncle's favorite authors as well. In fact, one of my uncle's first paranormal books that he picked up was by Jim, and so I had texted my uncle, and I let him know, and he had shot me back a picture of that dog-eared copy of Jim's book that he had on his shelf, and I think we just kind of shared a moment there where, you know, he said, "Well, I just kind of listened back just the other day to your last interview with Jim, and I thought it was really, really, really good, and I really enjoyed it." And I kind of reflected back on that last interview with Jim, and I remember asking him, how long do you plan on doing this, or how long do you, because most people just kind of think about slowing down or, you know, maybe spending time with grandkids or kids or maybe wrapping it up. And he said, "Oh no, I'm going to keep doing this. And as long as I can do it." He had a passion for this field. He had a passion for the material. He had a passion for what he did. And sure enough, he did it right up until the time he kicked the mortal coil. And that's, I think, you know, and even with Jerry and podcasting and telling stories all the way up until his last moments, he did what he did, and he did what he loved. Today, it's my pleasure to bring in Kevin Heil, who is an editor over at Visible Ink Press. And we're going to talk today about Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money, which is one of, again, I stress, one of Jim's last books. There's more than one out there, I believe. So let's bring in now to Darkness Radio, Kevin Heil. Kevin, welcome aboard, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much. Howdy.
Howdy. Let's talk a little bit about Jim. First of all, we can give you the bio. Jim, he's a master's degree in theology from Andover Newton Theological School. He was an ordained minister for over 40 years, which I greatly admired as well. He taught college courses in comparative religion and cross-cultural studies. He had a background in theology and education. He wrote more than 20 books in history, religion, the apocalypse, cross-cultural spirituality, the mysteries of the unknown. He had books for Visible Ink Press like American Cults, Hidden History, and Lost Civilizations.
He's also a talented musician. He was a trombonist, yeah, and even played on the for the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Yeah,
so, you know, he was a carpenter. He was a dowser. He was, hunter and fisherman and outdoorsman. You know, he was a lot of things. A fascinating man.
Very fascinating. And you know what I love, I think, the most about his writing style is his words really jumped off the page at you, and they grabbed you, and they brought you right into what he was writing about. I mean, you were right there in the scene of what he was writing about. You really felt transported. And yeah. I think that's what I love most about what Jim wrote about. He had that passion of what he wrote about, to the point where you didn't know it was Jim writing about what he was writing about. He really did transport you to what he was writing about. And for someone who was so theologically based, there was no slant to what he wrote about.
May I talk about his autobiography real quick?
Yeah, please.
Just mention it. Yeah. Just before he died, too, he finished his autobiography, Cosmo and Me, A Seeker's Journey from Religion to Spirituality, which is available online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble and stuff. And it's all about his life from the 50s in the suburbs of Detroit all the way to, you know, just a year or two ago. Paralleling that with his spiritual growth, you know, he began in the ministry as an evangelical Christian. He ended up, he was still a Christian, but, you know, very influenced by, you know, Eastern philosophy and Native philosophies and theology and stuff like that. And, you know, and he also comments a lot on the evolution of American society and parallels that with his life. So it's a very interesting book, also available on audiobook and Kindle and so forth. So it's a great book. I recommend it.
I definitely am going to read it. I was fascinated by the man myself. And he had talked a little bit about that, I believe, on his last appearance with us. We had talked a little bit about what makes someone who's, I don't want to say classically trained, that makes him sound like a musician, but someone who's trained to be clergy to want to step away and go a different path. And so we had talked a little bit about that on that last show. You know, and it was fascinating to kind of climb inside his head and his heart a little bit and you know, find out a little bit.
I had a lot of long conversations with him. We talked about spiritualism and stuff, and I think I agreed with his views like 99.9% of the talking, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I never met him in person, but I talked to him a lot. So, yeah, he'll be missed.
What was the most surprising thing, Kevin, as far as if you don't mind sharing, as far as your conversations with Jim, when it came to spirituality, what shocked you from your side? Maybe the most surprising thing that he said to you when it came to spirituality.
It just intrigued me that somebody who was an avowed Christian and believer in Jesus and everything could get into all this, you know, weird, you might think weird Eastern philosophy and the life after death and the spirituality of the world and how the interconnectedness of everything. So it was a very intriguing mix of Eastern and Western philosophies that he encapsulated, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I
don't see that very often. You usually see one way or the other, but not both. And he embraced both.
Right. Normally someone who's been raised in that theology, they very much, when you bring up something like Buddhism or you bring up an Eastern philosophy, they go, no, that's nice that they believe that, but, you know, there's that staunch belief that, well, I'm a Christian and Jesus is the way, but that's nice that they believe that, but that's not the right way. And they try to quickly steer you back towards the Christian religion. Jim wasn't that way. He would be quick to say, you know, it's all paths lead to one light or one paths lead to, you know, and he would be quick to tell you, well, you know, it's what you believe is what you believe.
Kind of open-mindedness is extremely rare.
Yeah.
Especially today.
Yeah. And it was refreshing, you know, that inclusivity and that, you know, to say, well, there's no right way. You just go, wow. Okay. You know, to say that, you know, the fact that as long as you're believing something and as long as you are of good of heart and pure of heart, you're a good person. And that, mm-hmm. that says something, you know, and that, you know, that was what was great about Jim. And he always had the right thing to say, and he always had the the right advice for the time, which was amazing to sit down and talk to a man like that. And that's what's so sad about not having him around, you know, especially, you know, for interviews or just for a friendly word, you know, that's rare, especially in this business, you know, as far as, podcasting and broadcasting, you hope to get a guest that not only can you just talk about the latest, work that they have, but you hope to get something a little extra out of them, you know?
And
Jim was one of those guests.
Yeah, I'm not much of a substitute, but I'll do my best.
No, you're perfectly fine, Kevin. You're perfectly fine.
I know. You know, I just feel like I can't fill his shoes, but I'll try.
Oh, no. This particular book is quite intriguing. Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money is a book that, you know, when you talk about things that inspire you, when you first start to read the book, Jim goes into it and talks about the things that inspire you as a kid, you know, the things that get your fancy, the things that get your juices flowing, you know, and that's one of those things I think we all can relate to. You know, you go out into the yard and you start to dig, you know, and you find things and you think you found $1 million, right? It turns out, you know, you might have just found a couple of bottle caps that aren't worth anything, or maybe you found a coin, but it might be, you know, it might be a bicentennial quarter and it's not really much of anything, or something to that effect.
But the fiction that influences you, like, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island.
Yeah. You know, but it's the tales we hear on top of the things we can physically find that get the juices flowing. And it's those tales that, you know, can we separate fact from fiction? And this book really does a really good job of that. Tell me a little bit about how much in your mind is fact and how much is fiction when it comes to the tales that we're told.
Most of the stuff is true that's in this book. You know, there's a couple of stories in here just for comparison that likely aren't. One is the chapter on hidden relics of Egypt, where some fellows that purportedly from the Smithsonian Institute, but they were not, but that's what they said there were hidden treasures from Asia underneath the Grand Canyon, and, you know, pretty much nothing about that story is true, but it's interesting to read because, you know, what people will buy and listen to, it's an interesting comparison. Another one that's pretty iffy, the one with the code, the Beale code, where's that? The little three sets of codes that people were trying to interpret, and we had, you know, people, experts on this, trying to decipher it for decades, and they never could, probably because it's just nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to get into some of the specific characters and some of the specific chapters, because they intrigue me a little bit, and let's see if we can flesh out some of these particular topics and
let me begin by Jim originally envisioned the book as kind of a guide to travel and go around the country seeing these different sites. So they were organized by state and region. I reorganized the book as by subject matter because I felt it worked better that way. So it's easy, you know, to have all the pirate stories together and the, you know, cave and mine stories together, the gangster and robber stories together, that sort of thing.
Well, that's interesting. So originally it was more like a travel guide?
Yeah. It's like as you're traveling through, you know, the Southeast Coast, you can go to these sites where they have, you know, where this treasure was lost, or go to this city where they have a pirate festival, that sort of thing.
Interesting. Because I know there's mention at one point in the book about Indiana and there being so much There being so much lost treasure supposedly in Indiana that it's ridiculous. Which I thought was an interesting notation.
Right.
Because you wouldn't think Indiana would be overrun with pirate treasure or any type of treasure for that matter. I mean, there's not much of anything.
Yeah, well, that area, because of limestone, it's riddled with caverns and caves. Well, there's lots of stories about, you know, Civil War gold being hidden there, or, you know, treasures from the Native Americans, that sort of thing.
One of the things that, to me, I don't know why the disconnect is there, Kevin, but to me, there's always been a disconnect. Let's start with pirates for that example. And I know you said you've reorganized based on categories. Let's talk a little bit about pirates, because to me, I have this disconnect in my head that for some reason, pirate lore to me seems the most fictional. But yet,
really,
yeah, I don't know why. To me, it seems like these stories to me have been blown out of proportion. But yet, they're very much real. And sitting down and reading this book has reconnected me to the facts of how real some of these stories are. I mean, talking about Captain Kidd and the fact that Captain Kidd was an actual real factual person. Not, I mean, there's so much fiction behind Captain Kidd. But why is it that when I read about Captain Kidd or have heard stories about Captain Kidd, I think, this guy is really a fictional character and not so much fact. What is it about him and his particular story that I want to think he's fictional?
Well, you know, because literature and movies over the years have turned these people into legends, just like, you know, stories about Davy Crockett and stuff have, you know, blown things way out of proportion. But fundamentally, like you said, they are based on fact. These, you know, there was a Captain Kidd, there was a Blackbeard, there was a Jean Lafitte. These are real people.
Interestingly enough, I mean, you bring up Blackbeard as well, and Jean Lafitte. The interesting stories of Jean Lafitte, hidden treasure, him taking on a whole different persona and then moving to North Carolina, that to me was incredibly interesting. And the fact that with Jean Lafitte, the fact that there is a sword hanging in a Masonic temple that had his inscription or his signature in it on it.
Mm-hmm. He had his initials or something.
Or his initials, or J.N. Lafitte.
Yeah.
To me, and that they had this evidence there for a very long time, yet never looked at it until two researchers come along and go, well, you know, what's that there? They look at it and go, oh, well, maybe we do have something from, because I forget the name of the moniker that he went by for the longest time.
You mean his fake assumed name?
Yeah, his alias. But he goes and resettles in North Carolina. Everybody goes, well, that can't be Jean Lafitte. You know, he's supposedly dead. And supposedly he had been carrying treasure around with him. Was that the deal with Jean Lafitte? But they said, well,
I think he kept a lot of the money, but, I don't know if they've actually been looking around, Lincolnton or in North Carolina for it. But I think that's a very true story and very, very, very possible that he did, survive everything and move and live under an alias. That seems feasible to me.
And what's crazy, especially about the Jean Lafitte story, is that he had such a business acumen that he wanted back into the United States. He wanted back in to play the game again, so to speak, that he wanted to make money again, that it was such a racket being here and making money that he needed to get back in, which tells you something about the days and times and what exactly you could make in this country in the time that he was alive.
Yeah, well, the interesting, Jean Lafitte was, after the golden age of pirates. It was in the early 19th century, and he was basically more of a criminal because he had, like, a money laundering business with the help of his brother, and, he was No, he kind of rides the line between pirate and just a plain crook.
But I mean, still, there was money to be had there, Kevin. Right. Mm-hmm. So he knew that there was more money on the inside than there was being out. Right.
Right.
So yeah. in order to get back in, he needed to get back in. So, you know, he took one of those old pirate trade routes in order to get back in, to get past the authorities, and got back in. But when I hear the name Jean Lafitte, I think Disney character. I don't think real pirate, but yet there he is. He's in the history books. He lived, he existed. There's a sword you can see.
There's also a hero of the War of 1812. Was considered a hero for a while.
A hero of the War of 1812, which, you know, I don't know why I assumed, and to me, like Blackbeard, again, another, to me, it seems like such a fictional character, which is like up here, which to me, I you know, has a real name, is a real person, existed. But to me, it seems, again, like a fictional character in a movie. I don't know why there's this separation with, as far as real people in history, seems to me like the most fictional.
Right. You know, some of the legends that cropped up, like Blackbeard, you know, being beheaded and his body swimming around the ship after being beheaded, you know?
Yes.
Whole thing. Stories like that, you know, but these people are interesting. They started off as privateers, you know, hired by the British government to harass the Spanish fleet and the French ships and stuff like that. And then when public opinion in Britain turned against that practice, they became villainized, and that's why they were arrested and you know, Captain Kidd was killed and Blackbeard were killed. So they were kind of betrayed by the British government. You know, they were just doing what they were asked to do.
That's for sure. And that's an interesting duality, to be sanctioned by a government one moment, and then the next you're a complete outlaw and you're out there doing what it is you're doing. Captain Thomas Cavendish, a perfect example of that. You know, Cavendish is the first to truly sail around the world, right?
Captain, because you know, Magellan, you know, he did make it himself, but nobody ever credits the crew. The crew made it the rest of the way. Nobody says, "Hey, you guys made it around the world."
Cavendish
was the first captain to make it all the way by himself, intentionally. Intentionally
make it around the world. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Cavendish not only intentionally made it around the world, but he also made it around the world while plundering and intentionally going out in the name of a government and plundering. But then he, in a devious way, went, well, you know what? I want to kind of keep a lot of this for myself. I don't want to take much back to this government. And got himself in a little bit of trouble.
Right. Yeah. Well, the government was like, okay, you rob all this gold, and then when you get back, give it all to us. And then he's like, fuck you.
that's a good way of putting it.
I'm going to hide some of it so you don't, you know, tax the hell out of it. Take it for yourselves, you know. I asked my last crew members a lot. I went through hell to get this. So, you know.
Well, you kind of did that to his crew members too, didn't he?
Yeah. The crew members were like, "You're screwing us too."
So in the end, there's a lot of speculation behind Cavendish and his crew too. I mean, wasn't there speculation that Cavendish might have ended up settling somewhere on a distant island?
Oh yeah, all kinds of stories, you know, anywhere from Hawaii to, you know, southern Polynesian islands and all over the place. Yeah, possibly.
Or his crew might have just taken him apart somewhere, and that might have been the end of it. Yeah. Which But in the end, he did get his recognition from the government. So there you go. I mean, you know,
yep.
He went out with dignity.
Oh, yeah. You know, other captains too. Captain Cook probably buried a lot of treasure too. Nobody ever mentions that.
True.
I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, other famous people hid money and aren't, that's really not talked about. So there's probably all kinds of stuff buried all through the South Pacific.
You know, and that brings up the question here, Kevin, with all the money that's supposedly out there, how come we're not running into more of it? It seems like with all of it that's been spread between the North American continent and the South Pacific and, you know, the deep sea, everywhere that it's been spread, how come we're not running into doubloons and pieces of eight and gold coins? How come we're not running into it willy-nilly?
Well, in some cases we are, with the Spanish fleet that sunk off the coast of, is it the Carolinas or something? And a lot of that gold that has been found, and you can even, you know, buy some of it online if you have the money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So some of it's been found. It's been estimated that under the oceans, there's probably over $30 billion worth of coins. But of course, a lot of that's really deep in the ocean and hard to, you know, without a lot of expensive equipment to get to. And if, you know, some of these people hit stuff down in caves and stuff, caves are dangerous. If you don't know where you're going, you're never going to, you know, the labyrinthine. They could be anywhere, especially like those caves in, like you mentioned, Indiana and such. Those are really, you know, you can get lost in those very easily. You can hide stuff and it'll never be found.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Tell you what, Kevin, we're going to take our break right here. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some of those other ancient relics. We'll talk a little bit about South America. And I want to talk a little bit about Civil War gold, which is interesting, and the way that the country may have been founded around gold. And I also want to get into Jesse James a little bit, and I want to get into the Freemasons a little bit, because there's something about a golden circle, which is very interesting. I want to talk a little bit about that as well. My guest is Kevin Heil. We're talking about one of the last books that Jim Willis wrote, which is absolutely fascinating. It's called Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money. It's available right now by Visible Ink Press. We have a link in the description of this program. I encourage you to go get this book. It's a fascinating book, folks. Lots of really, really fascinating stories having to do with everything from ancient Egypt to pirates to even right here in America. Civil War gold. Jesse James is involved in this. The Knights Templar is involved in this. The Curse of the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, and much, much more. When we come back, we'll talk about some of these stories having to do with America itself. We'll get into some different stories. Might even talk about Oak Island. That might even come up as well. So we'll talk about more with Kevin Heil right after this on the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the Best in Paranormal Podcasting. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Tim Dennis. My guest today, Kevin Heil. He is editor at Visible Ink Press. The book is a good one. It is called Lost Loot. And not just Lost Loot, but Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money. And it is written by Jim Willis. Jim Willis, as you know, passed away a little while ago. And one of his last books was this book here. Now, Kevin, I know there are some other books out there that will eventually come out. I know you mentioned that Jim's autobiography is out there right now as well. Is there a timeline for some of the other books that are coming out from Jim?
No, I don't. I don't think Invisible Ink is putting out any other We had some stuff he was working on, like there's a Bigfoot book, but since he passed, he didn't get started on that. I think that's pretty much it for Visible Ink Press.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Let's get into Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money. Now, before the break, we were talking about stuff that happened in South America, and we'll work from South America, come a little closer to home here. One of the interesting chapters talks about duality. You know, we were talking about Jim being not just a theologian, but having studied in the clergy. And one of the interesting parallels that's drawn here is the story of, I gotta refresh my memory here. It is the story of, is it not Quetzalcoatl? It's, is it Quetzalcoatl? I'm trying to remember.
Aztec god.
Yeah, the Aztec god, and he compares that to the story of Jesus and Lucifer. Is that the one that I'm trying to remember now? I'm getting old here, Kevin.
Are you talking about the chapter on Montezuma's revenge?
Yes, the chapter on Montezuma's revenge. And he also talks in that chapter about the lost, not just the lost treasure that's there, but also the curse that comes along with it, which is also interesting. I'm wondering if you can give us a little bit of that story, which is, I mean, Montezuma's revenge, whenever we hear that, let's face it, we all think of diarrhea. I'm not going to lie. But I just had to throw that in there. But there's also a little bit of a more fleshed out story, I think, that people don't really know about Montezuma, which is a little more in depth and a lot more interesting.
Yeah, in the book, he talks a lot about, Aztec mythology, the story of how in their mythology, the Aztecs actually originated from an area of the American South, what's the American Southwest now, and then migrated down south. And then, there were still, remnants of the civilization up north. And when the Spaniards came and basically destroyed their civilization, some of them managed to flee back up north and to take some of the gold with them. And, there's stories of it still being up there in, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado kind of region. So, and then there's stories in there about tech, curses, because the revenge against the Spaniards for basically destroying the Aztec civilization. So the gold was taken up there specifically so that Cortez would not get his hands on it, even though he got quite a bit of it. So up in Utah and stuff, there's supposedly one of the homes of Quetzalcoatl, the Aztec feathered serpent god, and also the legends that the Aztecs originated from the people who were there during the Younger Dryas civilization. That was archaeologists have confirmed that there were civilizations up there, and one theory is that a meteor of some kind came down and destroyed a lot of that civilization, not as big as the one that killed the dinosaurs, but still a significant one, so that those people had to flee, and that's what gave rise to the Aztecs and maybe some of the other Mayans and stuff down there.
And what's fascinating is just not to interrupt, but just the fact that if the Aztecs really were up in Utah and it did migrate as far south as South America, and that the fact that meteor would have drove them that far south, and that they did exist in North America all the way back that far, that messes with history. Really messes with history. And the fact that you had a literate civilization that went all the way back that far, that totally messes with our history books, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Jim also points out, the similarities between Aztec and Egyptian mythologies, and that maybe, you know, there were ties there. There, you know, a couple of stories in this book about, you know, possible Egyptian influences that made their way somehow to North America. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And the bit that I was alluding to earlier had to, yeah, actually I found it in the book here, had to do with, you'd mentioned Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, was the chief god of the Aztec religious system. It was represented by Venus, the solar light and morning star. His twin brother was, I'm going to butcher the name here, but Zeloti, right? The evening star. Now, in Catholic biblical imagery, Venus is the morning star, according to Isaiah 14:12. However, the morning star of light became a fallen star of darkness. The morning star of light became a fallen star of darkness. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? In other words, the mixture of Jesus and Lucifer, good and evil, was about to come into fruition in the persons of Quetzalcoatl and Cortez. Now, according to many historians, Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent or plume serpent, whom many Mesoamerican peoples claim was their ancestor, was an hombre blanco or a white man with a flowing beard. He condemned sacrifices that polluted the people. He taught them how to use proper cooking fires and showed them how to live together as husband and wife. He arrived from the sea in a boat that moved without paddles and taught people to live in peace. And under different names, he is found in Olmec, Mayan, and Incan oral history as well. And he's thought to be the inventor of books and calendars as well. He was the one that had given them maize or corn. And in some religious systems, he had been the symbol of death and resurrection. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yeah. So a lot of it, in fact, the Latter-day Saints believe that Quetzalcoatl might have been the resurrected Jesus Christ.
That reflects on, you know, the whole Mormon church thing, that Jesus came to the new world too and it spread his word. So I think Jim also talks a little bit about Mormon treasure. That Joseph Smith supposedly founded that, you know, the text of the Book of Mormon and stuff was on. So yeah.
It's all very interesting stuff. And to combine those two cultures, I mean, you talk about the Aztecs having some sort of tie to ancient Egypt. Then you talk about the fact that Quetzalcoatl might have actually been something similar, or made it might have even been Jesus in the New World, according to the Latter-day Saints. Now I'm going to get a bunch of emails. Watch, Kevin. Now you're talking about two different cultures kind of slamming into each other, and you're putting treasure and curses on top of it. It's a kind of a juicy little mix.
Yeah. There's another chapter in here that's always intrigued me about Lewis and Clark. You know, Meriwether Lewis was asked by Thomas Jefferson during his travels to research the language of the native peoples there, because Jefferson believed that the lost tribes of Israel eventually made it to North America, and that their language, the language of their the Israeli people, influenced like Navajo and the language of the native peoples. So according to Jim, you know, Lewis had a bunch of papers, research papers, documenting a lot of this that were stolen from him when he was found dead, possibly murdered. And, you know, what happened to those papers?
Wow.
That's one of my favorite stories in here that I did not know anything about. You always hear about Lewis and Clark exploring the American Northwest and stuff. You never hear about the research they were doing on Native American languages.
That's fascinating as well. Absolutely fascinating. Speaking of fascinating things on this side of the ocean, I want to talk a little bit about, let's get into the Civil War stuff, because the Civil War stuff is fascinating as well, Kevin. the fact that we always hear that the Civil War was somehow funded with gold and with treasure. There are a few stories in the book here that talk about this gold and this treasure that gets passed around and somehow funds, whether it be the North or the South.
California, because it was a free state and had a lot of gold. A lot of people don't know this, that because of California gold, that helped the North win the war. Without it, they might have been a lot harder. So a lot of the Civil War gold was stuff that was mined in California and then stolen by various people who were transporting it.
Which is interesting in itself, but mm-hmm. by other rights now, when we hear the stuff that really interests me, concerns me, makes me think twice is the Confederate side that claims that they had this treasure. Now, I've always heard a couple of different stories. When you talk about Revolutionary War and how the country started, you hear about a treasure there, right? I mean, have you ever heard about that story about how the supposedly the country was founded?
Actually, no.
No? Okay.
I don't think that's in this book, is it?
No, it's not in this book. No, it's not in this book. That's a whole different story for another day, Kevin. But I'll tell you that there's supposedly, which is, I'll bring it up in context to one of the stories that's in this book, which it kind of contradicts one of the stories in this book, which has to do with the silver. It says Silver War gold or not Silver War gold, but the Civil War in the gold that comes from the Confederacy. So there's a bit of a
contradiction,
thank you, between the way the country was supposedly founded by Masons and the gold that came over from, was it Europe that the gold came over from, and the treasure that was buried here for the Revolutionary War, and the story that's in the book here from Jim having to do with the South and slavery and how you have a band of Jesse James and others that want to keep the slavery movement going. Now, supposedly they're in bed with Masons. Can you tell me that story about the Golden Circle? And
The Golden Circle, that was a society or a group that of people from the South after the Civil War. They wanted to, regain, the Confederacy and start a new country that was not only the American South, but also Central America, much of the Caribbean, and parts of South America. And this would be basically a white-run state, which allowed slavery. And Jesse James apparently was with them and trying a part of, the money that he was stealing wasn't just for him, but also to help fund the Knights of the Golden Circle. That's the story there.
Mm-hmm. With that, now here's where it gets confusing for me. And this is kind of what I wanted to talk to you about. Because keep in mind that this is what I wanted to ask you. How much of that story do you believe is fact?
I believe that it's definitely viable. I mean, Jesse James obviously had sympathies for the South, and there was a Knights of the Golden Circle, and I think it's very potentially has a lot of truth in it, and like a lot of these stories in here, some exaggerations.
Okay, fair enough. This is why I throw this in there, because there's definite fact that there is some racist factions within Freemasonry. We get that, but there's also within Freemasonry there's also black chapters, So to me, it seems like, well, okay, in the South, and even in the South, you had black chapters in Freemasonry, right? So depending on what year this was, I don't think that far back there were black chapters yet in Freemasonry. So that would be a moot point on my part.
Okay.
But to me, it seems like even though you had, even though Washington, Jefferson, and others that were Masons that were founders of this country and were Masons, had slaves, bought slaves, traded slaves, even though they believed in slavery.
Well, at the time, you know, that's, you know, they had farms, and back then you had a farm, and you were had a big farm, you know.
Sure.
You probably had slaves, whether you were in the North or the South. Yeah.
Right. But I think, mind you, I'm this is truly conjecture here. I think they looked at it more as a business. I think the South probably looked at it more as a, I don't want to put words in people's mouths here, and I don't want people to fire off on me here. In the South, it was looked at more as a pleasure, right? Is that a way to, or as a, it was looked at more as a, and when I say pleasure, people are going to fire off on me when I say that. It was looked at more as a luxury. That's what I'm looking for, a luxury.
A luxury to have slaves?
Yes.
Or, I think it's, I mean, the poor workers, you know, obviously they just worked the fields themselves. Yeah, you had to have money to have slaves. You had to have a large estate to have any kind of amount of slaves. Sure.
Yeah. I think it was, as far as Northerners went, Northerners that eventually got rid of slavery, they realized that in time it was an abomination. They realized it was an abomination, so they got rid of it. Whereas in the South, again, it was looked at as a luxury item, right? It was looked at, and not necessarily, you know, when they fought for it in the Civil War, they realized, well, I don't want to get rid of a luxury item. And again, they dehumanized it in order to maintain it, right?
When you talk about the North, too, I don't think, you know, this was so much a matter of Northern morality as it was that the economics of the situation were just grossly different in the North versus the South. In the North, you had a harsher climate where farming wasn't as profitable and became much more industrialized, and you don't really have, you know, black farm workers for that kind of a culture. So it just faded out mostly.
Very true. Very true.
We can say too that, you know, obviously in the North, you know, after the Civil War, where there was a lot of black people moving to, you know, northern cities, there was lots of prejudice and lots of people.
That never went away. That,
you know, right. So, you know, it wasn't like the North was all, people in the North were all that noble.
Right.
It just worked out that the cultures, it was more conducive in the South to have, you know, black laborers.
Right. Just because you were free in the North didn't mean you were free from prejudice. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that never went away. Yeah.
So, but I think you're right that, you know, the larger, and, you know, a lot of the people in the government, you know, Thomas Jefferson and stuff like that, they were rich landowners with large farms, and they had slaves.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And of course, there's, you know, lots of stories of Thomas Jefferson having affairs with his the lady slaves.
Oh, yeah. And he
was not a, you know, yeah, a perfectly noble person.
Yeah, he had children with his slaves. Sure.
Mm-hmm.
A large amount of children with his slaves. Yeah. There are many, many children, descendants of Thomas Jefferson that are black. Yeah. How I got onto this, I don't know. Oh. So we're gonna go back to treasure. Difference between treasure.
The golden circle.
Yeah, treasure of the South versus treasure of the North, and the treasure that funded the Revolutionary War versus the treasure of the South, which is interesting because I had this conversation with a descendant of Jesse James, who's written a couple of books, and you may be familiar with him. what's interesting is Jesse supposedly had a network of treasure that went throughout the United States. And if you believe this descendant of Jesse James, Jesse was independently wealthy at any particular time, I guess, and could have funded, if he wanted to fund a South Rising again, he could have done it. Although it's I'm trying to remember now, based on the book, whether I'm trying to remember if he himself was a Mason and if he had other goals in mind. Again, it seems like the stories get convoluted over time. Was he engaged in Southern roots and Southern goals, or was he engaged in Masonic goals and wanted Masonic, machinations to happen? It doesn't, to me, it seems confusing. Is that fair?
For sure. I mean, there's lots of various stories about him. There's even a story that, he was supposedly shot. He was shot by Robert Ford, but there's a story that he wasn't actually, and that he survived that somehow and went into hiding. So,
and that's why
I think the hunt is actual body. So I don't even know where that story came from. But
that's what his relative claims. His relative claims that he survived that he lived to a grand old age, and that he remembers him. And not that he remembers him, but that his family remembers him.
It's kind of like stories about Elvis Presley being seen in McDonald's kind of thing. It's kind of wishful thinking on the parts of some people.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Let's move on from that. Let's talk briefly about. Let's talk briefly about. I want to talk a little bit about, before we leave people today, another treasure here that a lot of people have seen on TV. I want to talk about Oak Island. I want to get a little bit into Ark of the Covenant, Holy Grail. I want to kind of combine these a little bit in the Knights Templar. We've seen a lot of it on television as far as Oak Island goes. I want to ask you personally, Kevin, what do you believe is on Oak Island?
There might be some artifacts. I don't personally think that you're going to find, the Ark of the Covenant or something like that. But, there's lots of stories about people from the Vikings on to the Middle Ages and stuff like that, making it to Nova Scotia and Canada and parts of what's now the United States. And there's lots of evidence for that, including some that, they found the people who are in the Treasures of Oak Island show that's been going on for quite some time. I don't know, because it would have been extremely risky, given the boats of the time and the roughness of the North Atlantic to dare to transport, the Holy Grail, the Ark of the Covenant, that far. That's just my feeling. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But I think it would be too risky. It'd be a lot safer to hide it in Europe somewhere.
Do you do you buy into the Ethiopian theory that the Ark of the Covenant could be in Ethiopia or it could be in any other corner of the world?
Yeah, I think it could be pretty much anywhere especially in the old world. Yeah. We simply don't know. Same thing with the Grail. Same thing with the spear. So, but they did find some interesting things, like the Nolan's Cross and other evidence of stuff in Nova Scotia. So, there is evidence, I think, that some of the Knights Templar may have made it there. They might have been scoping it out as a possibility to hide stuff and maybe decided against it. But Or I could be dead wrong, and maybe it is in Nova Scotia. Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, it would be, definitely. When it came to 1307 and the Templar being executed, are you of a mind that there was a band of them that got away and dispersed, or do you believe that they got the majority?
Yeah, I think they had the Knights Templar, man. They were an organized group. They had spies everywhere. They knew what the church was up to. And, you know, even though a lot of them didn't get away, I think some of them probably did. Sure. Yep. And probably a lot of them fled to what's now the UK. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel it was necessary for Jacques de Molay to give himself up in order for the band to continue?
Well, then, you know, it would have been harder for him to hide, you know, and he could have drawn attention to if he went with that group. So, yeah, probably he made that sacrifice thinking it would be safer for the rest to get away.
There's a theory, I know it's not in the book, but there's a theory that I think it was our good friend Scott that came up with it, that eventually it was the Templar that became modern day pirates.
Well, I think they became other orders that are still in existence today, but I don't think they became pirates.
You don't think they became pirates, and that's where the skull and crossbones came from ossuaries?
I think they became other orders and changed their name to other orders of piety. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. That's fair enough.
That's my belief. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
I think the pirates are pretty much, like I said, the mostly coming from privateers.
From privateers. Yeah. That makes more sense. That makes more sense. I get that. I get that. Okay. Well, I tell you what, folks, the book is out there. It's available right now, and I encourage you to get it. Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money is available from Visible Ink Press. It's written by Jim Willis. It was one of his last works that's out there, and it's a fascinating book. It absolutely is. There's a lot of research that's been put into it, and Jim did a fascinating, everybody did who contributed to the book. Including yourself, Kevin, did a fascinating job and a wonderful job on putting this book together. Any last thoughts about the book before we leave people today?
Well, just there's a lot of stuff in here we didn't get the chance to touch on, like gangsters like Dillinger and stuff, and the Fabergé eggs and D.B. Cooper, and so there's a lot of stuff in here. So please do go get it online. It's a fun read from cover to cover.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have a link in the description.
Check out Jim Willis's other books on Visible Ink Press. He's got a lot of stuff, over a dozen books. So if you like this book, I'm sure you'll find some other stuff that you'll like too, on near-death experiences, book on censoring God, ancient gods, all kinds of cool stuff.
That's right. So we'll put a link not only to the book, but we'll put a link up to Visible Ink Press as well, so you can check out Jim's other works as well on Visible Ink Press. So, Kevin, I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, my friend. I want to thank Kevin Heil for being here today. The book is Lost Loot, Cursed Treasures, and Blood Money. That is one of the last works of Jim Willis. Just kind of in closing, I just want to mention that Jim Willis was one of my all-time favorite interviews. He really was. He was one of my all-time favorite guests, and I'm really going to miss Jim. Really going to miss just kind of the camaraderie, the off-air moments as well. Just kind of having the little side conversations with Jim every time I hear that one of my colleagues has passed away in the paranormal, a little piece of me goes with them, you know, and there've been quite a few in 18 years. And it gets a little harder each time I hear that someone who I've bonded with and formed a friendship with has passed away. You know, you, life doesn't necessarily get easier. It gets a little harder with each time that you hear that somebody you've gotten close to has kicked the mortal coil and they've gone to their reward, you know? I mean, there's opportunities to make new friends. There's opportunities to form new relationships, and there's opportunities to grow and expand and learn new things from new people. And that's the beautiful thing about life, right? I think the other thing too, and I guess the things that I learned from Jim in the short time that I knew him was this, that, you know, the things that we continue to pick up from people allow us to grow and change and become something that we didn't necessarily start out as, but it's a beautiful thing that we transform into as we go through life. And we're always growing and changing as we go through this life. I don't know of anyone at the end of their lives who says, I'm exactly the way I was the moment I came out of the womb. We all have people that influence us, that change our ways of thinking, and we become something different by the time it's time for us to meet our reward. Most of us, it's something new, completely different and better. Some of us, it's not. But all in all, we truly transform. I hope that the journey you're on is for the best. I truly do. I hope that the journey you're on is a good one. I know the one that Jim was on was an excellent one, and that he was on his way to finding everything that he was looking for in life. I know the one that Jerry Pauly was on, even though it was cut short, was a fulfilling one as well. He had the love of his life by his side. He had a great show. He was meeting enriching and fulfilling people. You know, we all wish we could have more money, right? I mean, that's always part of this deal. You're like, you know, I always wish I had more money, a bigger house, better. I mean, we all have things we wish for, right? But when you look at the overall standing of your life, sometimes you look around and go, you know what? I got it pretty good. You know, I'm not wanting for much. I think Jerry was in that place. You know, every time I talked to Jerry, he told me how life was good. You know, Jerry, I guess I dedicate today's show to you. I dedicate it as well to the memory of Jim Willis and two men who really had life quite good. I hope their afterlives are even better. I hope that when they see the face of God, that God smiles upon them and says, gentlemen, you set out to do what you wanted to do with life. You found truths that you were looking for, and you did an excellent job. That's really all we can hope for, right? That we did the best with what God gave us. We used the gifts he intended us to use. We did the job that he hoped we would do, and we were rewarded the way we were intended to be rewarded. I can't tell you what's at the end of this thing. I really can't. I'm no expert, although a lot of people would like to think they are. But I would like to think that maybe every once in a while I get a little sneak peek from different people who come on the show. And that's why I keep doing this show, because I'm intrigued by what's the ending at the end of this storybook, right? What is the ending? Even the people who think they have a clue, who've come on this show that have met their end, thought they had an inkling, and now they've seen it. And gosh, wouldn't it be nice to get a word in edgewise with them to find out if that ending was truly what they thought it was going to be. That intrigues me as well. Who knows? Maybe someday I'll meet my end and I'll come back and I'll tell you all. If I can find a way to do it, I'll do it. I know it's kind of morbid, but maybe that's my closing thought for today. Good shows coming up for the month of December, folks. I can tell you that much. I know that much going forward. That's about all I know. We've got some really good stuff in the hopper for you. Next week is going to be really good. I'll tell you that. I can tell you this much. I just got back from a screening of Nosferatu with Jessica. And boy, oh boy, what a movie. Jess and I will review it next week. You got that to look forward to as well. And if you have a story for either Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals, or if you have a Parashare story, please send it in to me, tim@darknessradio.com. I'd like to hear from you guys more. We hear from a whole bunch here right now, but I'd like to get those stories in from you, especially your own paranormal stories, your true paranormal stories. Send them in to me, tim@darknessradio.com. We'd like to air them on Supernatural News on Wednesdays. So this weekend, go out there and be a light in someone's darkness. Again, there's a link in the description of this program so you can donate. That's one way of being a light in someone's darkness. Donate to Tracy Pauly to help inter Jerry Pauly this weekend and help take care of some of those expenses. If you would, if you'd be so kind. I know it's a busy holiday season. We all have people to shop for. But with Jerry's passing, there's some ICU expenses. There's also some interment costs. So if you'd be so kind and do that, you could be a light in someone's darkness right away. $5, $10, it doesn't take much to donate to the GoFundMe campaign. I'd appreciate it greatly if you'd do that. That'd be a huge favor that I'd appreciate. Other than that, you can be a light in someone's darkness in other ways. I know there's snowstorms moving in different areas of the country. Go take your snowblower and help somebody out that way. By gosh, that'd be wonderful as well. All right, we got great stuff coming next week. Also, go tell a friend about the program. That'd be another way I'd appreciate it as well. Go tell somebody and let them know that we're here and to come listen to the program. That'd be great as well. All right, go enjoy your weekend. Go Vikes. That's all I got to say about that too, huh? Boy, do they need it. It's Falcons week. We've got Kirk Cousins. You know how I feel about him. I'm going to be by my TV this weekend, too. We'll see you next week. True Crime Tuesday, Supernatural News Wednesday. And, of course, we got a great guest coming up on Friday. Or that's Thursday, not Friday. I'm going to be resting on Friday. We'll see you next week for the best in true crime and paranormal podcasting. For Beer City Bruiser, for Jessica Freeberg, and for Mally Fox, I'm Tim Dennis. Thank you so much for continuing to listen to the best in true crime and paranormal podcasting. This is Darkness Radio.